This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Good evening, and welcome to Dialect Radio for the weekend of 16th and 17th of January. This week we hear from the UK Independence Party and ask them, aren't they just the Eurosceptic wing of the Tory party? We also have some more hedge trimmings from Malcolm Greaves, and our reporter Tony Gosling delves into 1970s radio archives to ask whether some stories about secret societies controlling our governments and religions may possibly even be true. Well, I'd like to introduce to the studio straight away Mr. Colin McNamee from the UK Independence Party. Hello.
Hi, John. Good evening to you.
We heard a little bit from you late last year before we broke up for Christmas, but you've come back because we did enjoy your conversation and interesting points and just kind of wanted to hear a bit more.
Good. Thanks for the invitation.
We chatted about bananas last time, and I understand there's been a little bit of a palaver involving some milk, which you would like. So we were discussing a lot about the EU and a lot of their legislation, and this has had a direct impact on milk over the Christmas period. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing the amount of information that's available without even looking for it if you just listen to the news. Today the news talked about the thousands of gallons of milk that's being poured away by farmers because of the EU Working Time Directive, which states because of the snow, there are two drivers going out with every milk collecting tanker, and that means 50% of the tankers are not being used. The second person is sitting there in the event that the hours of the driver are exceeded under the Working Time Directive. Now, this means that there's thousands of gallons of milk that hasn't been collected, can't go off, so down the drain it goes. Guess who pays?
Right. I mean, tell me a little bit about in Somerset and Frome area, your base on stand.
Somerton and Frome.
Somerton and Frome area. So how many branches have you got in the Somerset area?
There's seven right. In total, covering nine constituencies.
Right, and how successful have you been so far?
In the last election, we were very successful in that. In the European elections, in North Somerset, we picked up about 21% of the vote. In the Mendip area, about 19%, and in Taunton, 21%.
Yeah. Okay, what about the Bristol area? Because you're starting up in Bristol. How is that going? Where have we got to so far in Bristol?
Bristol's coming on. You're quite right. Late November, we re-established a branch in Bristol. Interesting thing there about Bristol. There are a number of ex-Liberal Democrats and ex-Labour supporters, so we're not just all ex-Conservatives, have leading lights within the Bristol branch. I now understand that Bristol is pretty well in a position where it will be contesting every seat in the constituency at the next election.
Right. I mean, you've got a lot of press, particularly with Kilroy's Silk in the past and such like. So how are you doing nationally? What percentage of the national vote did you get in this year's Euro elections?
Well, we came number two. I mean, Kilroy Silk was very much yesteryear. In my opinion, I think he did us some good and then some bad. He did us a lot of good in the Midlands where he stood. He was elected as an MEP. Then ego overtook. He made an unsuccessful and unwelcome bid for the leadership, and the leadership, not only the leadership, but the members didn't follow him. He went on to form Veritas and then went to oblivion as far as politics are concerned.
Okay, he disappeared.
Absolutely. But in the European elections in June, UKIP came second. We got 13 MEPs elected, two again in the southwest. We just missed getting a third. And up in the northwest, I understand your programme is broadcast out in the Preston area. Yeah. Well, up in the northwest, if we'd have received another 1,700 votes, UKIP would have finished up with two MEPs and Nick Griffin wouldn't have been elected.
Okay, that's a fair point. Now, obviously, you're a very Euro-based party. So Euro elections, obviously people are going to think about you, but surely their vote is going to be a bit wasted if they're voting for UKIP in a general election where other issues are going to be going to the fore.
Yeah, that's something the Conservatives like to say. Okay, well, we can ground that one straight away. A couple of months ago, Farage and Lord Pearson approached David Cameron with the offer that if Cameron was prepared to offer to the UK electorate on the basis that the Conservatives were elected to government, that if Cameron were to offer a referendum on the EU, then UKIP would stand down its 500-odd candidates and would actually help the Conservatives. Cameron declined the offer, therefore UKIP will be fielding over 500 candidates. But I think it really, and most importantly, flushed out David Cameron's position. He would rather, and he said himself subsequently that he was committed to the EU, and he would rather be in the EU, this is what the offer from UKIP has established, rather than offer the electorate a referendum.
Right. So you do seem to be a little bit of a one-trick pony to a certain extent, though. What else can UKIP offer, you know, if you're standing in a general election? What are your other policies apart from Europe?
Well, it's quite true that in 1991 through to 93, it was more of a protest party and a single-issue party. Certainly since and onwards from the 97 election, 2001, the 2005 election in which I stood, we have a full raft of policies. Mm. It's not just banging on about the EU. And by the way, we're not a Eurosceptic party. We're a Euro-realist party. Eurosceptics want to be in Europe and wish to change from within. We believe that the UK should be governed by those elected, and then we can trade with the EU, which I went into some detail when we spoke in December, but more importantly, that we can develop our trade globally. The UK is a global trading country. Yeah. We have full policies, whether it's covering defence, pensions. The important thing is that whatever our policies are, we're the only party that can implement them. Right. Because if we weren't in the EU, then we can actually govern for the UK. For example, the fiscal policy of the UK is now being manipulated, governed by Brussels. Take Gordon Brown taking over the Royal Bank of Scotland, for example. Cameron and Clegg both said he was a ditherer. He was only dithering because he had to approach Brussels for permission to nationalise a bank. Similarly with Northern Rock, and more recently, in talking about denationalising Northern Rock, he's had to approach Brussels for permission to do so. He wasn't dithering. Cameron and or Clegg would be in exactly the same position.
Right. I mean, there are a number of minor parties on the local scene and other protest groups and all sorts of little people. Do you have any sympathy, for example, with the English Defence League? They're a very sort of nationalist group who've been on the streets protesting about the Islamification of Britain. I mean, what is your such as that?
Well, UKIP is a non-racist and non-denominational party. Providing the parties are operating within the law, an area of concern could be the way Islam is being portrayed. It may not always be being fairly represented in the media.
Right.
But providing they're operating within the law, they have every right.
So anybody, for example, the Muslim community, they have just as much to gain from UKIP as anybody else?
You'll find that many Muslims are either nationally born, UK-born, or immigrants into the country, yeah, are very proud to be British, and knowing the British history, would like to see the UK governing itself.
Right.
People that they elect. Now, we're just coming out of the pantomime season. I wonder if I just might mention something to you,
okay,
about where a child says to its parents, "Daddy, do all fairy stories begin with once upon a time?" And the father thought for a minute and he said, "No, there's a whole range of stories that begin with, if elected, I promise."
Well, on that note, thank you very much for coming in, Colin, and let's hope that you know, we can hear some little bit more about what UKIP is doing and how it's performing in the run-up to the election.
John, thanks again for the invitation. Thanks for the interview.
Well, thank you very much to Colin McNamee there, and the website for that is www.ukip.org, ukip.org, and all their policies are on there if you want to have a look, and the number for the head office can be found on there if you want to get in touch.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, now from politics to a little taste of the countryside and something nice and relaxing, it's time for Hedge Trimmings, read by Malcolm Greaves.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. I want to talk to you about the ordinary everyday things which happen on my farm. I don't suggest for one moment that they illustrate the correct method of procedure. I realise that many of my doings are full of faults, and that I am not qualified in any way to instruct. But right or wrong, these farming methods comprise my life on this farm of mine. Of course, this farm is not legally mine. I'm merely its tenant. But on every count save that of ownership, I think of it as mine. My father farmed it before me. I was born on it. And I've spent practically the whole of my life on these 300 odd acres of Wiltshire's friendly landscape. I have known this farm in prosperity and failure. I've toiled on it and pleasured on it. Every square yard holds memories of either joy or sorrow. Ghosts, critical ghosts, of my father and his labourers stalk before me in every field. This farm is more than my business. It is my life itself. On these counts, surely I may at least think of it as mine. I am a grass farmer in the southwest, a Wiltshire moonraker, in fact. I expect a lot of people have noticed the rapid increase in grassland during the last few years in that part of our country. That glorious patchwork of golden grain, alternating here with a brown fallow and there a green root crop, which made the countryside beautiful to look upon, has been merged into a dull green sameness. Well, I'm one of the culprits. My farm is now all grass, all green, nothing but green. The romance of farming seems gone. There's no seed time and no harvest. There's no planning for future years. My fields were grass last year, they're grass this year, and they will be grass next year. Modern conditions have decreed this change, so farmers have had to bow to the wishes of the majority and change their methods. It is as though they said to the town voter and to the British climate, the two things which rule our farming, "We do not like the game of grain growing under your rules, so we refuse to play any longer, but we'll take you on at something else." In my view, a commendable attitude. Anyway, commendable or no, I have followed the prevailing fashion, have laid the whole of my farm down to grass, and have specialised in milk production. Quite frankly, I did not want to do this, but the urban voter, allied with our changeable climate, beat me. But given perfect weather conditions, I think I could have battled with the town voter, given him a longer run with my money anyway. If the town voter had not interfered, I could have struggled against the English weather with some measure of success, but the two together were too strong. So now I've got a farm. All grass, all green, divided into large fields by barbed wire fences, and inhabited by cows. My life is ruled by cows, morning, noon and night. In fact, I am their slave, and quite honestly, I respect my mistresses. If I do the work they set me, I do not think that they will let me down. Such faith cannot be placed in most branches of our home farming. Even between milkings, I'm still the slave of cows. If you have livestock, you can never say that you have nothing to do, for you can always go out and look at your cattle, and rarely will you find such a walk unproductive. I was talking to a farmer friend about this the other day, and he told me that one Sunday morning during these cold east winds last February, he was feeding some of his cattle on an open down at 7:15. He's a wealthy man of 60 or thereabouts, and there could be no possible need for him to be doing such an unpleasant job on a cold Sunday morning. So I suggested that it was rather foolish. "Oh, I don't know," he said. "You see, I woke up, and well, if you wake up, you might just as well get up. There's no point in staying in bed if you aren't asleep. There wasn't going to be any breakfast at home till 8:30, and I've got a lot of cattle, so I thought I'd go and give some of them their breakfast. It would be a good chance to look at them. I like looking at cattle. Any man who doesn't ought not to have any. But why choose a bitter cold Sunday morning for it? I asked him. Well, I wanted to see them under those conditions, he said. It's only by looking at them in all winds and weathers that you soak in the knowledge that really matters. You can't get it out of a book, and nobody can tell you. So whenever I have a free hour, I go out and look at my cows. A most enjoyable pursuit. I had an hour or so at it this morning. In order to please Trinket, my golden retriever, I took my gun. She greeted me with a grin of delight when she saw it. She likes guns, but she doesn't like cows. On these rounds of cattle inspection, she leaves me when we get near the cows and parallels my steps from the safety of the other side of the fence, turning up at my heel when any really interesting business is forward. As we neared the dry cows' pasture, I could see my old dairyman busy in the far corner of the field. So I left Trinket at the gate, guarding the gun and the rabbit, and walked over to join him. He was gazing at Gypsy and her calf in silent satisfaction. "Old girl managed it all right then, dairyman," I said. "Aye, she've a been drew deer's caper avore," he grunted. We stood looking at the animals in silence. Like most farming folk, we had developed the silent concentration of pure thought necessary on these occasions to a fine pitch of perfection. We just gazed. So did Gypsy. No uninitiated townsman was present to mar this beautiful, satisfying silence with empty chatter. The old man, Gypsy and I were in perfect sympathy with each other and enjoyed this hushed, revered contemplation to the full. Presently the calf struggled to its feet, Gypsy licked it methodically in maternal content, and the dairyman and I continued to gaze. It was beautiful. In a few minutes a milk cart in charge of a lad arrived, and having lifted the calf into it, the dairyman and his helper set off for home, Gypsy following close behind in great maternal anxiety. I don't know why I've told you all this. You'll probably take it all very silly, but it's all very true. If you don't farm because you love it, farming's no good. If you farm as a means to the wherewithal to get away from the farm, farming's hopeless. Not only will you not attain your material end, but neither master nor man will get any joy or satisfaction out of it.
That was Hedge Trimmings, and thank you very much to the talents of Mr. Malcolm Greaves. What if everything we thought we knew about British democracy was wrong? What if those claiming to represent us, not the MPs, but those MPs elevated to become cabinet ministers, actually making the decisions, had other loyalties? With less people voting in British elections than almost anywhere else in Europe, trust between the government and the people can indeed be said to be breaking down. Probably the most serious of the thousands of conspiracy theories are those that touch on the ancient secret societies. As soon as a member swears the oath of allegiance to their secret society, the question arises, who are you really working for, them or us? In theory, public officers who serve interests other than the public or fail to declare their interest and commit the serious criminal offence of malfeasance, that is, misconduct in public office. In practice, no one will know, and if they do, they may be afraid to speak out. 3 years ago, it became compulsory for everybody elected to public office to record their membership of secret societies, such as the Freemasons, in the publicly available Declaration of Interests. But what happens when they don't? Not because, since the membership book of Bristol Freemasons is itself secret... Oh, hang on, he hasn't written that right, that doesn't make sense. Oh, right, sorry. But what happens when they don't? Nothing. Because since the membership book of the Bristol Freemasons is itself secret, there is no way to check. Back in the early 70s, a man named John Todd started giving talks in American churches. He said that he had been a member of a secret society called the Illuminati, which was a weaving a web of conspiracy in American politics, but under threat of death had decided to leave.
he had come to see that his faith in Christ was not compatible with his secret society membership. According to Todd, the conspiracy included the occult, the Freemasons, politics, the international banking system, Zionism, and the Mormon Church. It is all these things, he says, and its power is finance.
Revelation 18:23. At the bottom of the scripture it says, "For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, and for by thy sorcerers were all nations deceived," talking of Babylon. There's no better scripture I know of in the Word of God to describe the Illuminati, which is what we'll be talking about tonight. And we're going to start. I want you to get out, if you can lay them across your lap, find the three pyramids. I think it'll be impossible to lay them side by side because on the purple sheet there's two of them. But we'll do the best we can with what we have. And take out the Sphinx. Now, most people do not understand the Illuminati. How many people here have ever done any study on the Illuminati before they heard of me? Okay? How many have done some since they've heard my tapes? A couple, okay? Boy, are the rest of you in for a surprise tonight. I don't want people to listen to me and walk out of here and just accept the things I have. I kind of like it when people go out here and say, "Boy, he's nuts." Because they'll go and they'll try and research to prove that I'm wrong. And the more they research, the more they start believing me. It is impossible to research history and to research the conspiracy and to research the Illuminati without coming away a solid believer. As the brother who prepared these, Brother Tom Berry, said, he went through almost 2,000 books for 20 sheets of notebook paper filled with notes. That's how well it was hidden. How many people have a set of encyclopedias at home, a good set? So home tonight, look up the word Illuminati. In some of the encyclopedias, you will find that it existed but does not exist now. And in other encyclopedias, you will find that it existed and still exists now. But they don't tell you anything about it. Before we go into it, I want to give you a reading list, okay? Now, I want to explain a book before I give its title. And I want you to choose carefully as to whether you want it or not. I don't want you later getting mad at me because I recommended it. It is not a Christian book. It is not a political book. It is an Illuminatus book. The book was ordered, written, and produced by Philip Rothschild, the leader of the Illuminati in this day and age. It was ordered, written by a woman named Anne Rad, and she was at that time one of Philip Rothschild's mistresses. It was written some 12 years ago. She was already a well-known author, and her books sell nationwide. She wrote this book. It was supposed to be a novel. It's 1,100 pages, so if you don't like to read, don't buy it. And it was written as a novel, supposedly, but it is a code book. And within the book is a step-by-step plan to take over the whole world by taking over the United States. Now, I'm going to say many things tonight that a lot of people will try and go out of here and say that I'm anti-American. No, I'm extremely pro-American. I couldn't be that until I became a Christian. But I'm extremely pro-American. I am just anti-government that exists within America today because it is not the government of the people any longer, and I'm pro-people government. That's a term misused by communists a lot, and I'm sorry if you're upset that I use, but that's exactly what it says in the Constitution. Now, the power of the Illuminati, and I'll give an explanation, the Illuminati is as following. Okay, first, most people found the Illuminati in things that have crossed their path. People found it in the occult, and mistakenly they have said, "Aha, the Illuminati is the occult." Then they have found it in the Masons, and they said, "Aha, the Illuminati is the Masons." Then they have found it in politics, and they said, "Oh, it's politics." So they found it in the international banking system, or they found it in Zionism. So they list it as just being that. Actually, it is all these things, and much more. They have found it in the Mormon religion. That's because the leaders of the Mormon religion are high echelons in the Illuminati. They have found it in the John Birch Society. That's because the man who leads the John Birch Society is both a high degree Mason and a Mormon. But it is all these things, and its power is finance. If you would take its finance away, which is impossible. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you the name of the book, and I just realized that. I started out. I'm getting ahead of myself. The book is called Atlas Shrugged. Oh, Atlas, you know, Atlas supposed to hold up the world? Shrugged, like you shrug your shoulders. Atlas Shrugged. Now, this is the warning that goes with it. I'll be talking about occult books tonight and how demons are in occult books and in their music and so on. This isn't so with this book. They didn't place a spell on this book because they did not want people to buy this book other than those told to buy it within the occult and within the Illuminati. They are extremely mad because just this year alone they sold several million of them, mostly to Christians, and they don't like that. In fact, they've tried to stop printing it, and people don't want to stop printing it. They're making so much money. The bad thing about it, though, is that since it is written as a novel, it has some passages that I think might belong in Hustler or other places. Maybe out of 1,100 pages, you might count five that are this way. You can tear them out and throw them away. They're just stuck in there to hope. They're stuck in there on purpose to keep Christians from reading the book. So if you should get to a passage that is a little something you shouldn't read, just turn to the next page. It'll be over by then, and you can go on with the story. Now, if you don't like to read, skip the first 200 pages. The first 200 pages, they're very boring. No, actually, they're the conspiracy from people in all the walks of life talking about this incident happening and that incident happening. And it's very boring to the fact it lets you know that it's the conspiracy that's planning the incident. It's like reading the newspaper today. You don't really know what's happening behind it. But after about the first 200 pages, 8 chapters, 9 chapters, something like that, it starts showing you that everything that is happening is conspired to happen. And I'm going to give all these things, and I want to say something before I give the rest of the reading list. The common name for the Illuminati is the conspiracy, or the great conspiracy. Now, until we lost the school system to people within the organization of the Illuminati and so on, you were taught in your history classes, and some people can remember this if they want to confess up to being that old, that history was taught that it happened because somebody conspired for it to happen. Then we didn't want in this nation anybody to get ideas that maybe our government was a conspiracy. So they decided to start teaching that it just happened because it happened. You know, World War II happened just because some people got mad. World War I happened because some people got mad. The Depression happened because we bought too much too soon without enough money. They did not want anybody to get the idea that it all happened because somebody conspired for it to happen. But I hope to accomplish one thing tonight more than anything, that I will change your attitude, that I'll set new forms or patterns or whatever in your life, that you will walk out of here and when something happens, you'll go, now I wonder what they're really up to.
That was alleged ex-member of the Illuminati, John Todd, speaking in the United States in the early 70s. And I'm now joined by Dalek Radio's Tony Gosling.
Hi, John.
Hello. Was John Todd part of the anti-communist paranoia in Cold War America?
Well, I think it's probably fair to say to a certain extent he was, because at the time, in the 1960s and 70s, with the height of the Cold War, the prevailing view was that the communist empire was an atheistic empire which was out to destroy America and the rest of the world. There was quite a lot of people in America who were on that particular bandwagon. And but the thing is that with John Todd particularly, is he wasn't so much focused on the communists as conspirators within America, and he believed that there was a whole conspiracy within America to actually wrest control of the country away from the people, as it's supposed to be in the Constitution. So although he was a little bit, I think it's fair to say, a little bit paranoid about the communists in Russia and China, he was much more focused on pointing out to Americans that America's democracy wasn't working and it was under threat.
Right. I mean, it's anti-communist element as well as it being political. I mean, you also sort of insinuated there in passing it was also sort of like a religious thing as well. Sort of like the religious America versus what they viewed as atheists.
Well, this is one of the things that that John Todd says, is that there's two sort of different sides to this particular conspiracy that he said that he was actually involved with for a while himself. One is the political side and the other is the religious side. The way he pointed it out was that it was important for this secret society to control both parts of the politics of the country and also to control the sort of spiritual side. So these are the two traditional power bases ever since really medieval times have always been the church and the government or the king, depending on what type of government you've got. But right. He said that this conspiracy was directed at both.
Right. What about this book, Atlas Shrugged, by Ayn Rand?
Yeah, Ayn Rand wrote this book, Atlas Shrugged, and he's just talked about that in the excerpt we've just heard. Atlas Shrugged starts off, as he says, as a book which is very, very boring for the first 200 pages or so.
Right.
But then it really gets into the nitty-gritty of how And she's writing really in a sort of way, exposing tactics for placing big events in the press and in the media, making things happen in the national dialogue, which are actually serving a conspiracy rather than just happening naturally or occurring naturally. So that there is actually an attempt to put things into the press, make things happen, which will have an effect on society as a whole, rather than them just happening at random.
And particularly, I would draw people's attention to, if you want to read and find out more about somebody, a particular individual who has done that, and there is an awful lot of evidence, is Basil Zaharoff, the well-known arms dealer, all throughout the late Victorian and right up to the 1920s, a very famous person who did an awful lot of that. So who are the Rand Corporation?
Well, it's the same surname as Ayn Rand, but the Rand Corporation is a separate organisation who were connected very closely with American military research projects. Like, all the military have quite a lot of, shall we say, funny money, because no one ever really is sure that you're going to come up with a new military weapon when you're spending money. But the Rand Corporation were looking at military research and development, but particularly with regard to things like psychological warfare. So we're talking about, you know, getting stories into the press which demonise a potential enemy. Mm. That then builds up a case for justifying a fight, an attack or war, whatever.
And an arms race as well.
Well, yes, and but that's what the Rand Corporation were doing. They have branches in throughout the Western world, but they are pretty much at the core of some of this more dubious psychological style of military research.
Right. So what evidence did he actually show for a secret society called the Illuminati? This is a pretty core question.
Well, it is. One of the things he said is that the society was very meticulous in that it never kept records. So obviously evidence is not an easy thing to come by. Yeah. Having said that, he did talk about various aspects of American national life that the conspiracy was involved in. So I really think that this isn't something that I would necessarily proffer as something which is definitely 100% true, but I think it's interesting to listen to, as we just heard that interview, and then just let people decide for themselves whether they think there's something to John Todd or whether he's some kind of imposter or whatever. I think it's, you know, my own opinion is that he was definitely involved in something. Quite what is another question.
Okay, is this Illuminati still a present day organisation?
Well, that's the big question, and I think you have to look at the historical evidence of its existence. This is one of the reasons why John Todd is an interesting character, because he does appear to be a bit of evidence that this society does still exist. The best evidence actually comes, though, historically from the 1700s, from the late 1700s, when there were a lot of Freemasons themselves. Who were actually talking about the Illuminati in a very negative way, saying this is another secret society that is trying to infiltrate us.
Right. I mean, it's always quite appealing psychologically, you know, the Illuminati. You know, if you want to identify the ills of the world, it's all right. There's this sort of convenient sort of Moriarty figure sitting in the middle of a web somewhere.
Well, that's right. And this is a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because one thing you can do is you can blame everything on them, everything bad that happens. Yeah. Famously, the famous Boxing Day tsunami, a lot of people were, you know, writing things on the internet saying, oh, this is the Illuminati again, you know. So there is a psychological problem with it. It's much easier to talk about one organisation or you know, to blame one network for things which sometimes may be random occurrences.
Yeah.
You know, but having said that, that doesn't mean to say that powerful networks don't exist.
Okay, so what evidence have we got, you know, as to sort of something that has been influenced? I mean, you spoke about how difficult evidence was, so I would all respect, it's almost like, what do you believe? How far do you believe their influence spreads? You know, what kind of things can we attribute to them?
Certainly the French Revolution. There's a lot of evidence, very good evidence, that the French Revolution was actually fermented within the Freemason lodges in France by this network, the Illuminati, because at the time, the late 1700s, there was plenty of evidence which came to light during and after the French Revolution that it actually was talked about, discussed, and plans were made within these secret Masonic lodges in France. Now, French Freemasonry is a bit different to English Freemasonry.
Right.
It's called Grand Orient Freemasonry, and it is basically an atheist organisation, whereas Freemasonry in Britain and other parts of Europe was nominally Christian, or at least, you know, believed in God in some fashion.
I mean, that might be quite interesting to a lot of British people, because part of my fundamental understanding is that it was primarily specifically a religious movement, whereas, you know, there can be completely other different reasons for having a Freemasonry lodge.
Okay, the secret societies flourished and thrived mainly because so little freedom of speech was really allowed in wider society. So if you were a public figure, there were certain things you could no way could you even suggest.
So these were like speakeasies, if you like. This is some way you can go.
Exactly. And this was the heyday of Freemasonry, really, I think it's fair to say. It's when but the thing was, we're in a very different situation now, where there is actually a good deal of freedom of speech, not necessarily freedom to be heard, yeah, but you can pretty much say what you want.
So the cause and the effect of, you know, the cause of the coming to being is now completely almost polarized from the actual effect of what they are like.
Well, that's right, and this raises the question, doesn't it? Well, what is going on in these Masonic lodges now? Is it just a, you know, sort of way to have a cup of tea and dinner together? Yes. What's the point? I would suggest that actually what these Masonic networks now have created is actually a perfect place for crime to reside, because you know, people who enter these Masonic lodges do swear an oath of allegiance to their fellow Masons and to the craft as a whole, and the temptation may be to actually ferment crime within these little secret networks. So you know, it's difficult to know what they're actually up to now, but I would say that there is a temptation to that. There's always going to be.
Right. Where can we go and find any of this evidence? Where can we find out more?
Okay. Well, there's probably the best written book about the origins of the Illuminati, which includes, translated into English, some original German writings of the founders of the Illuminati. This is Adam Weishaupt, who was a lecturer at Ingolstadt in Germany, a professor and an ex-Jesuit. So a lot of his writings and other people who were actually senior aristocracy in that part of Germany at the time did write stuff which was then subsequently in German, which was then subsequently leaked in the 1700s and translated into English. But as I say, it makes it pretty clear what their objective is. It's to influence politics and the whole world of government, as well as religion, and those are the two mainstays of it. And I'll just read you a little quote from really the best source on the origins of the Illuminati. This book is The Proofs of a Conspiracy by John Robison. Now, Robison was himself a Freemason and wrote the book because he was annoyed about the way that Freemasonry was being, or as he saw it, infiltrated and influenced. What he says in this book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, which was published originally in 1798, and it's available up on the internet because it's out of copyright, the great strength of our order, and this was written by Weishaupt himself, the founder of the Illuminati, the great strength of our order lies in its concealment. Let it never appear in any place in its own name, but always covered by another name and another occupation. None is fitter than the three lower degrees of Freemasonry. The public is accustomed to it, expects little from it, and therefore takes little notice of it. So there he is himself saying, basically, that what we want is a secret society inside a secret society. So Illuminati within Freemasonry.
Right.
So that's, as I say, available on, I think it's called sacredtext.com on the internet. You can read and print out, or you can get a paperback copy of the book, Proofs of a Conspiracy, which is actually a fine read and includes all the stuff I was telling you about the evidence of the Illuminati fermenting the French Revolution and the killing of really the entire French aristocracy. That was seen, by the way, to be retribution from the Middle Ages. If these people hold grudges for a long period of time, right? And the Middle Ages,
pan-generational grudges.
In the 1300s, the Knights Templar were put down by the King of France, were arrested, rounded up, and Jack de Molay, who's their Grand Master, was burnt at the stake, and many other Templars were killed. Now, it's said that the French Revolution was so bloody, really, so that all of the descendants of Philip the Fair, who was behind that particular rounding up of the Templars, would be killed, and there would be nothing left of the blood of Philip the Fair. But that's even after, 1300, 1400, 1500, 1600, 1700, that's over 450 years later. So that seems to be the mindset that these people may operate on, but then it's very difficult to actually prove anything to do with these secret societies. One of the things I think that does mean that you can prove is when their actual writings and papers are leaked, and that's the case with this Proofs of a Conspiracy, so I thoroughly recommend it.
And on that bombshell, let's end there. And Tony Gosling, thank you very much for speaking to us in person about this fascinating subject.
No problem, John. Thanks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'd like to introduce the Bard of Windmill Hill again. Hello.
Hello, John. Hello.
Hello. What have you got for us this week?
Well, first I'd like to mention a cabaret evening, which is going to be happening very close to here in the Portwall Tavern.
Ah, excellent.
Which is facing St Mary Redcliffe. So it's very easy to find. A huge car park right in front, so no parking problems.
Yep.
So there's going to be a cabaret night on Sunday the 31st.
Right.
Only a fiver. Tickets available from the Portwall Tavern. Or you could contact me for further information or reservations on 0117 966 5514.
Brilliant.
It's mostly music, but there'll also be some magic and special effects and all sorts of wonderful things. Only £5.
And will this involve Magic Simon?
Magic Simon? We'll have to wait and see.
Oh, we'll have to wait and see. Is Magic Simon going to be there or not?
Yeah.
Okay. And you've written some more poetry for us?
This is, this is something about, in the news, one of the main items of last week, the coup, which didn't quite work.
Yeah.
The clueless coup. It was planned for Wednesday afternoon to try to get a secret vote. But it all ended up in misfortune as no one climbed aboard the boat. They hoped it would be Brown's high noon and instigate an instant coup, but it seems Mr. Brown's immune to plots hatched by a secret few. So if you're planning to do a coup, you'd better not use Mr. Hoon. He's a leader people just poo-poo. He comes too late or much too soon. Nor should you enlist Mrs. Hewitt, as planning coups needs guts and guile. Though she'd mean well, she'd only screw it up and hide herself away a while. True revolutionary leaders are not like Hewitt or like Hoon, who are a pair of silly bleeders who lend themselves to this lampoon.
Excellent rhymes with Hoon there just at the end. Very much pleased with that. Our next feature is from Anthea Page, and it's an interview with Len Scott from Brislington, who reminisces about his early days in the Merchant Navy and in the Bristol docks back in the 1940s.
My name is Leonard Walter William Scott, aged 86, born 2/12/23.
Tell us about your life in the Merchant Navy.
I was an ordinary seaman, and I went away on my first boat, was called the Lobus, and she belonged to the Pacific Steam Navigation Company. We left Liverpool in convoy and went down to Colon in the Panama Canal on the Atlantic side. Lights are bright was the core when we entered the canal, because we were now entering a no-war zone, the Pacific. After going through the canal, we did, I think it was about 8 ports. We went down to ports like Antofagasta, Talara, Aikiki. We were just like a delivery ship.
Just general cargo?
Just general cargo. We then loaded iron ore in Valparaiso, and we were now homeward bound.
What date was this?
This, I'm talking about late 40, 1940. Came up to the canal, through the canal, up to New York, back to Liverpool, 4.5 months, roughly. Then I was allowed to go home. I then joined the Covina, a banana boat. She went to New York. Then I joined the Jamaica Producer, another banana boat, that went to New York and returned to Weymouth. After I'd made the voyage in the Lobus, I came back to Bristol. I was allowed to come back to Bristol, all right? Seaman's Mission.
Yeah.
Was in Princess Street.
Oh, yeah.
Dead opposite the Shakespeare, the old Shakespeare that was there. Next door to the Shakespeare was what they called the pool. It was like a labour exchange for merchant seamen. A Captain Hillier was the man behind the counter. And he gave me, I went down on my bike from Brislington, because there were no cars there. And then he said, I want you to go standby on the Bristol City, one of the city boats that sailed from Bristol docks. They were about 1,200 ton. Small, very small.
Where is it moored, that boat?
Up where the cranes are now. I said, oh, well, I haven't come prepared because I just rode down there on my bike from Brislington. So he said, well, all you would do is stand by in case somebody don't turn up, then you've got to go. He didn't turn up, so I was left with my bike on the boat. She was proceeding to Cardiff or Swansea, I think it was Cardiff, to bunker, coal bunk. She was a coal burner. When we get down to Cumberland Basin, they lower the basin to meet the level of the river.
The Avon.
Avon. Before proceeding down to Cardiff to get coal for the journey. And lo and behold, as the Cumberland Basin lowered and the lock gates were going are opening, the seaman who I had replaced as a standby came out the Rose of Denmark and staggered towards the boat. Immediately, the first mate that was next to the captain shouted down, hey, you, get on your bike. And as the chap who was joining the ship, who was drunk, who I had replaced, reached the bottom of the ladder, I gave him a mouthful, me bike on me shoulder, up the ladder, and waved goodbye and went home. And the ship, Bristol City, proceeded down to Cardiff. But in any case, had he not turned up, she would have gone to Cardiff and she'd have been down there for 3 days. And I would have come home, picked up my gear and gone back and joined her.
Can you tell us what Bristol docks were like in those days?
I joined a Bristol steam navigation boat that went to Dublin. Cargo back was Guinness, the drink Guinness. They were docked. The Bristol Steam Navigation Company had their berth on the Hotwell side of Bristol Bridge in the basin, in the dock. You know where Princess Street is? Their place used to be there for unloading the Guinness.
Just tell us about the atmosphere in the docks. Was it jammed full of boats all unloading? Was it noisy?
Yes, it was noisy. And there was the over by where the museum is now. That's over the Park Street. There used to be a line of ships that used a little, they weren't big boats that come to Bristol, remember? The city boats were the biggest boats that got into Bristol. They were about 1,200, 300 ton gross or net before they were loaded. They were the biggest boats that came into Bristol.
Was it because of the Avon then?
Well, yes, it was because when they used to go down, they used to have what they call the pill sharks, used to be on have little boats because they were always in the mud lot as they went down. But it was interesting because I later went on the Bristol Dock Company dredgers, BD1, bucket dredger, BD2, then there was BD4 that operated in Bristol, the small ones. I used to come up to the feeder, do all the dredging up there.
What was the most interesting experience that you had with the dredgers?
Well, you can imagine the BD1, which was the biggest of the dredgers, could only operate out of Avonmouth. And we used to do tide work that was roughly 5 hours on, 2 tides a day. So whatever the tide, at low water, we used to join her out on the south pier. She didn't enter the docks. She used to dredge between the two piers in the main entrance to Avonmouth. Beg your pardon. The Severn, which was also a suction dredger, used to work between the two piers. And it used to suck the slurry off the water and then go down to little Denny, the little island off of Porter's Head, and pump it out. And she used to do five dredges a tide. But the BD one used to do all the bucket dredging in the main dock.
What date was this?
I'm talking now about late 44. Those in June, you may be sure who go to sea. A ship is a thing that you never can be quiet in. By wind or sea, 'tis all the same to saw with me. Wife and daughter on the water said they'd like to sail a bit. I consented, soon repented, and began to rail a bit. Papa, no played.
That was Anthea Page talking to Len Scott about his Merchant Sea days. Well, Jeff can't be with us this week. He's travelling space and time, but he's sent us his What's On in Bristol, and I'm going to read this to you now. Good evening, he writes. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday the 21st of January, Cast Off Kinks, which features three of the original Kinks lineup, will be performing at The Tunnels, which is in Bristol next to Mews, near to Templemead Station in Bristol. The doors open at 7:30 p.m. and the tickets are £12 each. Moving on to Friday the 22nd of January, Dark Horse will be performing with support from Figment at the Louisiana in Wapping Road, Bristol. The doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. It is definitely worth noting, says Jeff, that Dark Horse have been named the ones to watch in 2010, no less, by magazines Classic Rock and also Metal Hammer, so worth watching out for. For more information, you can check out myspace.com/Dark Horse England. Moving into Saturday the 23rd of January, Guns to Roses will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. The doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on the 23rd of January, Evil will be performing at the Thekla in Bristol. The doors open at 7 p.m. and the tickets are £10 in advance. Also, I know on the 23rd of January at the Lakota, Domma Roland and Calyx are DJing. That's more drum and bass orientated stuff. I think the tickets are going to be £8 for that. That'll be worth going to. Finally, on the 24th of January, the Randy Swindlers will be performing at the Coronation Tap, which is at number 8, Sion Place in Clifton. That is S-I-O-N, Sion Place in Clifton in Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and the entry is free. That is all from me, brackets, Jeff Sparks, obviously. Thank you very much for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye, says Jeff. Wherever he is, we wish him well. OK, so how long have you been back in England?
It was today, Tuesday. 2 days, 3 days.
Tuesday, okay. I guess you're still feeling pretty exhausted, I imagine.
Yes, I'm ready to go back.
Okay.
They need me there.
Yeah.
They need the medicine, so I'm ready to go back again. Feeling tired but happy.
Okay. Did you leave your lorry behind or did it come back?
No, I left it behind in Gaza.
Ah, why is that? Right. What happened there?
Sorry?
What happened there? Why did you leave it behind?
Well, that was the plan, leaving it there, and so they can get some use out of it.
Oh, I see. Okay, okay.
Yeah, so medicine plus the lorry.
Yeah.
You know, they can't have no lorries there. I've seen few, but not many of them.
Okay.
So they have what extra ones? The hospital could use it, or sort of maybe some other use.
Okay. So how many vehicles eventually went into Gaza?
I think we were just over 200 and something, so we had to leave about 47, I think it was, the very latest figure.
Okay.
But they were still, they were taken to back to Syria, some of them back to Turkey.
Yeah.
And conditions are in Syria, the Palestinian refugees, are quite actually bad. I could even say that's even worse than in Gaza.
Yeah.
So they're taking back to Syria some of the vehicles so they can use it over there.
Right, okay, that's interesting. So how did you find your interactions with the Egyptians? Because, you know, they weren't very helpful.
No, they messed us about. They, first of all, I Moscow, but they never gave us permission to go across to Nuveiba, to Egyptian side. Then obviously they told us to go back and go back to Syria. Made it difficult, obviously. They thought we didn't have enough money, but this Turkish organisation called IHH, they actually put the money. I don't know how much it cost, but I think it was around about $200,000.
Right.
It cost them to get the vehicles over there, plus, I think, $30,000 each way, a flight to El Arish.
Right.
So that's, I don't know how much it add up to. And then, obviously, once we got there, they organised another flight, chartered another flight back to Turkey. So 300 odd of us gone back to Turkey. We had to escape from Egypt because we have been actually detained from the Rafah border to Cairo airport. They put us into about 8 or 9 or maybe 10 coaches. We weren't allowed to go out of the buses, or we weren't allowed to go into toilets, nothing to eat. We haven't eaten anything for about 24 hours. And we weren't allowed to do anything. They just keep showing their guns, taking out of their whatever, and showing us that they have bullets. You know, it's like threatening us in a way that if you do anything stupid, we'll shoot you.
How did it feel being stuck in the middle of you know, so much politics, and all you wanted to do was just sort of get through with aid?
Politics, did you say?
Yeah, I mean, with Turkey and the Egyptians and...
Well, I mean, the main concern was to get this medicine there after that. Once I've delivered my goods there to Gaza,
I mean,
I've done my bit, so I don't care about the politics, if there was any politics.
Okay. This is the second sort of humanitarian relief mission that, you know, the convoy that's happened. I mean, what's next?
Sorry, I didn't catch that.
This is the second humanitarian relief convoy, so what's next? Is there another one?
Well, if there is another one, I'm ready to go. If they need help, and I'm ready to go back again.
Okay.
So despite the difficulties that we had, I still think it was still easy. IHH made it easy for us to go there. But I think there's another convoy happening in March if it goes ahead.
Yeah.
And I will obviously do my best to, if I can go, I will go. If I can't, then I'll do my best to get stuff together and send it over there.
Okay.
There's still needs for medicine and sorts of equipment there. So, ready to help as much as I can.
Did you make any sort of lasting friendships on the journey? Are you going to keep in contact with a lot of the people there, or that you went with?
Oh, yes. We do have this Bristol Guard Link website. And we have got loads of people asking, you know, what they need, what their needs and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously we're gathering it together. We're still, you know, doing things. And we will be helping them and just keep in touch with them. I know there's another convoy going next month. I'm going to get stuff together and try and send it with them.
Okay, brilliant.
From Scotland, yeah.
Okay.
I sort of know everybody in this game, really.
Yeah.
Helping the people of Gaza. So I've got all the contacts so far. And I want to do my bit.
Brilliant. Okay, well, Shakir, thank you very much for talking to us. And, you know, glad you made it back okay.
Yeah, thank you. No problem.
Thanks for talking to us.
Cheers.
Take care. Bye.
Well, that's all for this week's show. Dialects Radio is a weekly podcast produced by volunteers and broadcast on BCFM 93.2 FM across Bristol at 9 o'clock every Saturday evening and repeated at 12 noon every Sunday. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or download our podcast from dialectsradio.co.uk. You can also see us at bristol.intermedia.org.uk. Or you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. Thank you to our studio guests Colin McNamee, Trevor the Bard of Windmill Hill, and also to the talents of James Smith, who read our little feature this week. Our reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and the studio production was this week by Mark Condon. It's his last week this week. He's going off to abroad. Whereabouts is it again?
Tanzania.
He's going off to Tanzania for 6 months. Lucky chap. And the producer was Tony Gosling. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute.
So if you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or if you'd just like to come along and see how we put a show together, please get in touch via volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Just lastly, just to remind you that the cabaret evening that was advertised by Trevor the Bard of Windmill Hill is going on in the Port Wall Tavern opposite St Mary Redcliffe's Church. That's happening on the 31st of January, and you can give him a buzz on 0117 966 5514. And this is John Pickett's Club, and wishing you a very good week. Take care. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectradio.co.uk.